Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is a show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. And it's not just science fiction books, it's also fantasy books, which is what we're going to do today. And joining me today is Juliana Kunzendorf, my girlfriend. Say hello, Juliana.
Hello.
Now, this was your book. Tell us why we're reading this book.
Okay, I got a recommendation on Goodreads of... a friend on Goodreads called Tudor Chocali, or I don't know exactly how it's pronounced, but he said, this is earlier than John Dowland, but I wish I had your music as background soundtrack when I was reading this novel.
Now you've got to explain what's going on there.
Okay,
though.
First of all, maybe you know that I work as a musician, I'm a singer, and I do Renaissance music from English Renaissance, and... John Dowland was a lute player and composer.
You do some Italian stuff as well, don't you?
And now, yeah, I do lots of stuff, but we now also do some Italian madrigals because it was kind of influenced in English court singing and court music playing in general. And so that fits quite well with...
So do you have a CD of John Dowland music?
Yes, I actually do have a CD. Unfortunately, which I really am a bit sorry about, it's not available on iTunes, which maybe I should do. It's only available on Amazon.
As a CD,
you buy it as a CD, as a physical object, which is probably a bit dated
right
now.
It's a bit weird, isn't it?
Yeah, well... but you also can go to the website geomusici.de.
This is becoming an advert for your music CD.
The point is that you
know medieval music and courtly music, more Renaissance music, but this is right in your wheelhouse.
Exactly, this kind of court music, which is it's always about adoring a woman who you can't achieve, because she's the married woman to the duke or the king,
or it's Queen Elizabeth,
as in Dowland's music. It is always singing about his queen, Elizabeth I.
Yes.
And
even though he was Catholic, wasn't he, or something like that?
He was baptized in young ages when he was like 18 or something, from the French. He was baptized Catholic. But he was actually like a true just English person. He wasn't really like so much about religion, but... In the end, it turned out that wasn't a good idea to be Catholic when you want something from your
queen,
English queen. Mm. And so that was a bit of a trouble. It's quite an interesting story. This could actually make a novel itself.
Well, that's kind of what we have here. But the point is that John Dowland was like the superstar of his day at the same time that William Shakespeare was the playwright, and was the big, guy like this. In the court, there was like one superstar, the rock star of the day was the songwriter and performer,
He was there to entertain the court people and the high ladies and gentlemen and all these guys.
So this is all a setup for this book. This was a recommended view. It's called A Song for Arbonne, and it's written by Guy Gabriel Kay. And it features, it's not in England and it's not Renaissance. It's kind of more earlier, sort of like, it's slightly earlier medieval
13th,
times.
14th century.
Yeah, 13th, 14th century. And it uses a similar kind of idea that the troubadours and the jugglers, which is the people who write the song and the people who sing the songs for the songwriters, are some of the biggest stars in the world. And their one job is to go in and entertain the court. But what their job really seems to be is to go in and keep the women, the courtly women, happy, like the duchesses or whoever's been married off this place and that place, like a marriage of convenience or a marriage of political maneuvering or something like that.
That was just normal at that point.
Yeah, but it's funny that in this book, where it's taken up to that next level, that it's pretty much assumed that if you have a successful troubadour and they come to your castle, they're going to sleep with the duchess. They're going to sleep with the countess or whatever it is.
It's even kind of like a challenge.
Yeah, it's a game.
Yeah, it's a game. So the troubadour has to sneak in and try to sneak in, and the guards of the duke has to...
But it has to... It's like a... it's one of those challenges. It's like he has to be good enough at writing songs about her to make her more famous, and kind of as a reward, she will then not only shower him with gifts and favors, but also sleep with it. But it's when the book first started, I wasn't quite sure what the setup was. It's like, is it a bad thing? Like, you know, it starts off with this mission. Actually, after this first little bit, like a prologue, which is sort of set in the past, it starts off with this guy, and he's like, "Right, we've got to go, and we've got to get this guy back from this thing. He's a troubadour, and he's run away because he tried to sleep. Oh, did he try to sleep with it, or did he not try to sleep? Anyway, but there's this weird thing, and I was going, what's the conflict here? What actually happens? And it was like, oh no, the Duke. He didn't sleep with his the troubadour didn't sleep with his wife. So the Duke has sent this guy off to grab this guy and bring him back to the castle to make sure that he fulfills his real duty, which isn't just to write songs about the woman and then leave. It's like
it's also to make her happy.
Yeah, it's also to make her happy. And I was like, wait, so and it kept on this, and that was such a relief to me that it's like, oh yeah, this is actually kind of feels real. Like it's the kind of stuff that now we look back on history and it's like, what was the job of these guys really? But so much of history, or so much of culture, and that we see is it used to be a lot more, not more open, but it used to be a lot more accepted what happens. But now, with our view back on history, we go, it couldn't have all about been about sex, could it? It's like, yep,
yeah, all it about was. It was, and especially, you know, sometimes I think in our days we're way more like, what's the word, prudent?
No. Prudent, yeah,
yeah. And in these times, it was all about, you know, people were married for several reasons, for political stuff.
Yeah.
And then you, I mean, of course you're together and you have to have like a court thing going on.
Yeah.
But I mean, in that times there were gay dukes, and
yeah, of course.
What would the wife do? He has to be married.
Yeah.
And he has to get
and that's
an
what
heir
happens in
stuff.
This is one of the troubadours. It's like, well, this is a troubadour. His speciality is that he's a gay troubadour. So when he goes, he's singing songs to the wife, but then going and you know, going off with the Duke.
Entertaining
the Duke. Yeah. And in that case, the gay one has to have and this is a weird thing, that he's gay, but he's got a female singer. So it's like, well, who's going to service the wife? You know,
it sounds like they knew how to get their fun somehow.
Yeah.
It was an open thing.
It was an open thing. And this is one of those things, but what I'm trying to say is like, It kind of feels like this is a kind of more grown-up view to fantasy, like medieval fantasy, where you just go, no, it's open. Of course this is what's going to happen. You know, there's so many things that, like, look, even, like, I was in the Amazon, and we were talking about the Amazon dolphins. You know, there's dolphins that swim in, you know, they go into the Amazon. And one thing was like, oh, you know, they say that when there's a young girl gets pregnant out of wedlock, they say, oh, it was one of the Amazon dolphins came over, and you know, she swam with the dolphins and the dolphin made her pregnant and stuff like that. And you'd go, oh, that's it, why is that? And it's like, oh, is it because the dolphin's penis looks very human penis like and that could be it. But the real thing is, which probably everyone knew, it's that these families would live on isolated villages along these places, and it was probably his father fucked the daughter. And then you're just like, oh, so you say it's the dolphin that's the reason why she's pregnant, so we don't have to admit that the father raped the daughter. Oh, okay. Like, and you, but it's one of those weird things that, I mean, that's not what we have in this one, but it's one of those things that you just go, oh, there's all these stories, these myths, these like different ways of looking at life, which all came up, and it's like, oh yeah, it was to cover up the scandal of the day.
Yeah.
And all of this folklore that comes together, and it's just like, yeah, it was a scandal at the time. We made up these stories, and then 200 years later, we just have the stories.
Yeah, and this is what left over.
Yeah, this book seems to address the scandals, but it wasn't scandalous. It was like, oh
no, it was just normal.
But
let's maybe go a bit to the book itself.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Let's start off with one of these scandals,
the characters, and maybe we should just put in some music beforehand to get people into the mood of it.
Yeah,
let's just listen to some of the.
Yeah, you put it on, then press play, and we'll explain what's happening here.
Yeah.
Turn it up. I don't think it's coming through very loud. No, leave it plain. Let's leave it plain.
Okay.
So this the setup of this book is very, it's like an alternate southern France, isn't it? Provence.
Yes.
And it kind of says that at the beginning. And there's a map and it says, oh, this is this place. And actually, I brought the map up just to make this a bit easier here. So Arbon is there, and so the north is Gorhout, which is kind of like middle France, and then there's Arimonde, which is kind of Spain, and then Portiza, which is kind of Italy, and there's Gutsland, which is kind of Germany, that kind of thing like that. So it's like a fake... It's kind of a fake Southern France. Turn that down a little bit now. Fake Southern France, and you know, based on Provence in this, you know, in this medieval period, you know, they had all the courtly lovers and stuff. So at the very beginning of this book, there's these two castles very close to each other. There's Talayre, where a guy called Bertrand is, and Bertrand is the son of a second or third son of a, say, duke. I can't remember, count, whatever, something like that. And so he's not very important. So he becomes a troubadour later on. His brothers die, and he becomes the duke. But at the beginning of the book,
it's not his. It's not supposed to be
him. It's not his political maneuvering. And then across the lake is Miraval. Oh no, it's the other way around. Whichever way around it is. So there's Miraval, and there's Urta, another count who goes across there. And the beginning of the book starts off, and it kind of lays the foundation between these two dukes' relationship. And it comes down to a wife of a duke who one of them loves, really loves. It's not just like a marriage of convenience, but it is kind of, but it's not. You know, there's an important marriage there. And then he's the troubadour, but who later becomes a duke, seduces this woman. Again, I'm not going to give it too much away, how it happens at the beginning of the book, but it's an interesting beginning to the book.
It is very interesting, the beginning. And I really enjoyed how this was like, it was a storytelling, and then it was kind of cut off.
Yeah.
And over the whole beginning of the book, you were always thinking about, what happened? What happened?
What is the history between these?
What is the history? What really happened? And this was what, our character, like our main character, also
didn't know what happened.
Didn't know what happened. And we are in the same position as he
was. But also, other people, there was actually only two people who knew what happened in this case.
Yes.
And I don't want to give away who those two people are. But one of them would never say for reasons, and the other one wouldn't say until the other one's dead. Reasons as well. So while there is a mystery there, and I was like, oh, what could this mystery be? But it's just, it sets up one thing, what happened between these two people, and it comes out little bit by little bit, like by little bit. And it seems to be kind of known among the, like, the dukes and the, you know, the aristocracy, but then it's kind of not really misunderstood. But there's this really big, really bad blood between these two dukes. But however, that's just one part of the story.
Yes.
Another part of the story is that Gorhout and Valença were always at war. These are the two countries north of Arbonne. They're always at war, and then there was a really bad battle, and one of the kings was injured, and the other king died, and then other people took over, and then they kind of settled the war and bought stuff from each other. The Northlands, you know, parts of the Northlands were... Yeah.
There was this treaty.
A treaty, and it didn't go down well, and people were abandoning it. So what happens is that the main part of the story is that Gorhout is now at peace, and because it's at peace, it goes, we're no longer fighting Valença, let's turn our eye towards Arbonne. And there is it his name Garsenc? There's the King Adhemar and Garsenc, who are the main bad guys.
Yeah, and Galbert de Garsenc.
Oh yeah, Galbert de Garsenc. He is like, he's like the Pope of the North, and he's like, hey, these people in the South, they have their own god, and the god in the South is a female.
It's a female.
And that's the opposite of our male god. Even though in the South they worship both gods, but they're like, hey, we only have one god. It's a heresy. So let's go on a crusade. That's pretty much the reason why he wants to invade.
Also, they treat women in a totally different way, which we are going to get explained very clearly in the setup of the courts and stuff.
So, but that's the setup for the whole thing. However, our main story follows a guy who is a mercenary, and the mercenary is, you know, he's employed by one of the one of the dukes. Is it Malmont or Remy?
Bod.
Oh,
that
Bod,
was his first one.
Yeah,
the first employment.
And he's employed to go and get this troubadour off this island, which is a fun setup.
Yeah,
like this. And
it's really funny. He fled there.
Yeah.
And then they're going after him, and he's grabbing him on his shoulders. And
they're
like,
don't,
really,
but that's
funny.
A holy island, so don't kill anyone and don't do anything. And they're not knowing it happened, and it's actually really fun. It's like action, and you're like, ooh, hope nothing happens. Yeah. But it starts off with some really good action, and we follow our main guy called Blaise throughout him, and we follow him as he discovers, as he works for these different dukes, and he, you know, he never pledges allegiance this way, but he gets embroiled in the political situation between these two houses either side of the lake, these two dukes either side of the lake, and also with the main, you know, story about Gorhout and Arbonne and their budding war that's coming in the future, that seems to be inevitable, that's coming. But also, because he's the guys from very patriarchal, misogynistic gohout in the north, and then he comes south, he's like, oh, all these wussies, they're singing songs to each other, and the women are in charge, and the women have too much power, and women can just, you know, they can do what they want, you know, if they want to be a singer, they can be a singer, if they want to be a tradesperson, they can be a tradesperson, you know, all these things that the women have, it's not, they're not equal, but they have a lot more freedoms, they're a lot more open, and they have a lot more power.
Yes.
And in the north, they're like, this won't do, and he comes in there, he's like, this won't do, and he's like, oh, actually, not everyone's weak and womanly.
Let me just do one thing and correct your pronunciation of these things.
So, oh, okay, what?
It's not gohout, it's go-or.
Go-or?
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, because H-A-U-L-T is pronounced O.
No, but it's not A-U-T-L-T. It's A-U-T. There's no L in it.
Yeah, but still, it's O.
Okay, and what else did I say wrong?
That's all for now. I think that's...
Okay, so my French pronunciation isn't as good as Juliana's pronunciation. So what do we like about this book then? Should we go talk more about the story? I don't want to get too much into the story, but there's, like I say, there's these different...
Yeah, it's so easy to spoil anything. So
it's not that it's easy to spoil something, but what I like about it is that I could just say, oh, this happened, but the whole point of the story is it's a constant revelation of actually what's going on.
Yes.
But it's not just there's a certain mystery and then what happens. There is so much political double-crossing, but it's not just like, oh, just do this or just do that. Everybody seems to have different allegiances and different reasons for why they're getting involved.
Yes.
It seems a very grown-up, even though it's fun, even though it's quite frivolous, even though it's like, aha, I challenge you to a duel, and oh, let's go and have a meeting here, oh, and I'm going to sleep with you, and we're going to have a marriage over here. There's all of the different machinations of this, of politics, but it feels, I don't know, quite grown-up. Even though it's very playful, it's kind of grown-up.
Yes, that is the thing. It is this very nice mix between... things happening and story building and character building and you know it's really, as you say, it's playful. It's really it's just sometimes it's mostly really light-hearted or whatever you say that. And so it starts off sucking you into the story, being really fun to read and fun to follow along. Mm-hmm. And later on, of course, there are troubles going on and stuff, but then you don't mind so much anymore because because you already are so much into the story and with the characters it's not so like really, really grave. Is that?
Yeah, it's not grey. Yeah, in a way, it's not like overbearing.
Yeah, exactly. And what I really like about this is that you have so many, like there are many, many characters. You have the upper bit of the people. You have
aristocracy,
the dukes and the duchesses and the whoever, and the king and whatever.
The counts and countesses. And there's
but
knights.
But also you have, because it's also about the troubadours and the jugglers, which I find a really funny word. They are like not so high-born people. They're just normal people. And they like kind of earn their living, not quite so much with money, but like with getting... accommodation and food and stuff at the courts.
And they get their stuff bought for them, like they'll have a coat bought for them, or they'll be given some jewelry that they can sell or give away themselves.
So, and this, we learn a lot about these simple people, like simple in like.
Well, this is the thing. I don't want to. One of the reasons I read this is because if you remember back, I did the Curse of Chalion podcast together, and at the end you said, "Hey, let's see. This is something like that," because that was like, "Hey, this is fake medieval Italy." No, Spain, isn't it? That was fake medieval Spain, and now this is fake medieval France. Yes. And you said, "Hey, we should read it." And one of the reasons why I enjoyed this book so much is because it wasn't Curse of Chalion. It's like the anti-Curse of Chalion, even though it has so many similarities.
Yes.
One thing that I will at the end I'll do a whole section of why I enjoyed why this is the anti-Curse of Chalion.
That's good.
But one thing that I want to bring up here is that one big problem that I had with Curse of Chalion is that everybody who was important to the story and anyone who had any time spent on them at all either was a prince or a duke or castellar or whatever they called them in this one, or was secretly a duke or a castellar or a prince, and like all of these characters who did anything. And then at the end, it's like, oh, we need some more characters to come in and help out the main guys. Well, who could these be? Well, let's have this duke and this knight. And it was never just like, and here was a normal person. Like the only normal people in that book was like, and then the scullery maid came in and sorted them out. and, you know, cleaned up afterwards. And it was always just like, oh, and then the page boy came in and gave this message
but
and then left
no
again.
Names.
They were interchangeable, had no names. And no, but more to the point, it wasn't that they just weren't there. It was everybody who had any impact or affected the story at all was highborn in some way, born into privilege. But what I really liked about this, what you're saying, is that there's lots of people who, just a guy who just happened to be a soldier and is like, oh, I'm going to go and become a soldier, I'm going to become a hired sword. And they could, it kind of felt like they were working their way up into importance.
Yes.
And there's some singers who was like, oh, what do you do? I was a singer. How, you know, how did you make it as a famous singer? I had a good voice. You know, they're not born into it. They just had to work at it and do well at it. And they could improve themselves in their station and things like that.
So and there's this one... like, they're different couple, different people. Like, they always travel together. It's, like, always a troubadour and, like, the singer, the juggler. And they travel together. And there's this one pair where it's actually said, oh, he is not so great and stuff, but he's improving. And then you see, they read about him and how he's improving and stuff. Which is really something I like, because people develop.
Yeah, and it's the same with the priests and priestesses, you know, that when they're doing their stuff and the knights, like, it's like when people work at something, they do get better. Now, there are, of course, lots of people who have rich parents who come in and it's like they swoop in and go, aha, I've got a rich parent and that's why I'm here. But there is a little bit of social mobility, and it seems to kind of encourage that in a way, that people should work at what they do. You're not just going to be fantastic at something just because you happen to be born into the right family.
Yes. Also, what I wanted to
there
say...
There is that element, of
yes,
course.
Yes, there is
fantasy,
that element, but the main character, Blaise, it's pronounced Blaise. He actually really wants to keep a secret of his highborn status.
Yeah.
He
just... Spoiler. It's okay.
As I say, it's so easy to just... But, well, come on. You said...
It's obvious. It's obviously what he's going on here.
Ah, well.
Okay. Okay,
it's
what
not
else?
Bad.
What else did you like about this book? There's lots of good fun stuff.
So, I like the music. I like I really enjoyed the language that he writes in. I mean, of course, as always, with The Hobbit as well, there was somebody else on Goodreads writing this about it. I always a bit trouble with reading songs and then imagine in my head they're singing these songs, which is still, even though I'm a musician, it's quite a challenge.
Yeah. Also, I quite like the idea that the songs are in translation, because you think, oh, these should rhyme and there should be a meter there, but it's not. It's like, this is what, in French, it would be this, but I'm not going to try and translate the French.
Yes.
I'm not going to try and translate the rhyme scheme and the meter into English.
Yes.
I'm just going to put across the sentiment and the word.
Exactly. So that was sometimes a bit in the way, and...
But I thought they were really good, actually, of those songs.
They were good, but in my head, they weren't songs.
Oh, okay.
And that is always a problem.
The thing I liked about it, the political manoeuvring in this, is because the song for Arbon, like, what was a song for Arbon? Was it the song that the Duke wrote about the king in the north just to piss him off? It's like, you know, these songs aren't just frivolous. Sometimes they're political propaganda.
Oh, yes. They're really, like... pissed off people, like the one song that he wrote, and it's just like a huge thing.
Yeah, it's like what it was a song to make the two northern kingdoms go to war again against each other.
Yes.
And to stir up the people of the northern kingdoms against their king, you know, if they heard it being sung. And you're like, that's clever. That's actually, well, it's not just clever, it's like that's something which isn't always done in fiction, you know, that kind of stuff.
And also, according to this point, I also really like the changing of the characters within the story, where you think, this guy is like that.
Yeah.
And then they have a conversation, and this conversation is like really like crisp, and they have these...
Well, an example.
Like, I don't want to spoil things.
This just say two characters,
like,
so I know which ones you were talking about.
There's this king from Valencia. And they meet each other, and then and he asks, they talk about to each other, Bertrand and the king.
The Dukes,
he's like asking, did you actually like really meant what you wrote in that song about me? And he said, well, yeah, I quite did.
Yeah.
And but then they have this nice kind of humor, saying, oh, okay, well, it's a song. Let's talk about it. But that is it. And then they kind of work stuff out.
Okay.
And this is what I really like. These really different levels of
conversation and character motivation. Yeah.
Yes, and also sometimes really you think like the Duchess of Arbon. She is she's the important person in Arbonne because her husband died.
And it's just her. She's been left in charge, yeah.
She's been left in charge. She was really in love with her husband, which is not normal, and which is pointed out a lot of times that normally when you have this kind of marriage going on, it's like a forced marriage or something. But they were really in love, and she's never interested in any other men, for example. But she also has... She is a really wise woman. Like, she's appeared to be, like, very... like wise with grey hair and stuff, but then also she sometimes has these fun conversations, and then she's really clever. She's really clever, and you don't really think that from the first moment.
Well, that's the thing, because the people looking at her think, oh, she's just an old woman. Yeah, yeah, not what's going on there.
And yeah, so I actually think this book is so well thought through. However you say that,
it's well thought out. Like
everything is. Thought about. It's not something, how can we match this together? Oh, I just write something about this here. And no, but you really can see that this guy had a chart, like castle of his house, where he puts under the characters and then the combinations. And
I mean, what I really like about it is that there's so many characters, but they all seem to meet each other at one point. It's like, oh, I wonder what those two people would do if they meet up. And then they do, and more story is revealed and more stuff is revealed. Yeah, so I like just the fact, like just the pace of this story. Again, coming back to Curse of Chalion, there's more pace, there's more story, there's more politics, there's more character progression in one chapter of this book of Song for Arbonne than there is in the whole of Curse of Chalion. Literally chapter after chapter, more stuff happens. And like after Curse of Chalion, where it was like 19-hour audiobook, and by the end of it, it's just like, fuck, nothing's happening. Here, in the prologue, I'm like, woohoo, and then chapter one or part one comes up, chapter one, and it's just immediately stuff, you're just off to the races straight away. There's a tryst by a lake, and then there's something else goes wrong, and like right at the very beginning in the prologue in this actually, no, I'll get to that later on let's get into this one thing I like about the structure of this is that there's a prologue, and is there a... oh, shit, I didn't mean to do that. I'm looking for the table of contents here. So in the table of contents, it goes here, prologue, then part one, spring, part two, and there's three chapters. Part two, midsummer, and there's like five chapters. Part three, autumn, part four, winter. So this story is told over the course of exactly 1 year, exactly like Curse of Chalion. That starts off in the spring, goes all the way through the winter, and ends in the spring again. That's what this does. But here, what I liked about it is that, as opposed to Curse of Chalion, is that here it goes, right, so we go on here, and this is a chapter with action, where story happens, where this goes and that goes, and they get back. And then there's another chapter where that's the same amount of story happens, and it's like, okay, and now you come over here and work for me. And then he goes there, and action happens, and stuff happens, and let's get on with it. So there's three chapters, and all of the times in between where nothing's happening, where someone is traveling from one place to another, or waiting around, or just spending time at court where nothing is happening, just skips past all of that and just goes, right, now we're here. It's 3 weeks later. And
we spent the time there.
It's still
and now
spring.
It's this.
Yeah, it's still spring, like that. Then we get to part two, and it's midsummer, and we have five chapters. And each chapter lasts, what, like some of the chapters last 10 minutes, some of them last an hour, but it all happens over the course of one evening and one night. Yeah. And as I was going, I was like, oh, midsummer is Midsummer's Night. It's a festival where everyone comes together into one place.
It's not summer.
It's not summer. Midsummer. It's midsummer. It's this one day. It's Midsummer's Night, and it's a big festival. And of course, because it's a big festival, everyone's together. So all of the politics can happen at fast forwards, and all of the action can happen fast forward pace, and all the meetings, everyone's going to be there. So if you need two people to meet up, that's where it's going to be. So all those five chapters happen in one place. And then part three, autumn, and then you have an autumn festival, like, you know, your harvest festival. Well, it's not a festival, it's like
Lausanne,
which is in the north, and it's where all the traders get together, and there's markets, and there's lots of singing and dancing.
It's quite central.
Yeah, it's very central.
It's like central. People can go there from everywhere.
Yeah, it's not just Arbonne, it's all six kingdoms. They all come together into Lausanne there, and it's not just the people from Arbonne, it's all like the princes and kings and countesses from everywhere else come in there as well, and there's jousting and other fighting and stuff. And then all of that action happens over the course of like 4 days or so, yeah, or a week or something like that there. And then the stuff that happens in the winter is a little bit more spread out. But again, there's none of this waiting around between, unlike the Curse of Chelion, where like two chapters go by and you go, well, what happened in those two chapters? And what happened was time passed very slowly. Like
everything
stuff
was
just happening. Everything was like, and then they went swimming, and then there was a feast.
And the thing is, there's still enough time for us, the reader, to imagine details. And what I really like about this kind of stuff is that if an author gives the reader the room for imagination to imagine the details, to imagine the colors, and to imagine how it looks like, and not everything is described.
Yeah. Like, they didn't need to say, and the people of Gorhout wore this kind of coat, because it's like northern France. It's going to be different than southern France.
Yes.
You know, it's like, you don't have to explain it. And also, what I loved about this book is that, again, as opposed to Curse of Chelion, but I don't want to compare it, but this is just what happens, is that Guy, did we even say who wrote this or when it was written?
Yeah, you said who wrote it.
Okay.
You didn't say when, I think.
I don't know. I don't have Goodreads open in front of me. You have Goodreads open.
Oh, it's
so,
here.
Guy Gavriel K, he kind of trusts...
He wrote it in 1992.
Okay. 1992.
Yeah.
That's quite old then.
Yes,
I didn't
is.
Realize it was this old.
Yes, it is.
I thought
from the 90s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Also, he's from Canada, which
okay.
I think it's amazing to say, but he also worked in England.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to say is that he trusts us as readers to put two and two together, but then doesn't think that we're going to think it's... like, for example, you were saying before, oh, he's a count. Like, you say that the main guy, Blaise, or Blier...
Yeah,
Blaise is a count. But it's kind of... like, it's quite obviously that he's going to be important and he's got the skills. He's obviously a man of war and stuff like that. What are you doing? Don't click on Wikipedia. You've
no,
got Wikipedia on your...
No,
why
don't.
Are you clicking on my Wikipedia?
Oh, sorry, Zinger. Sorry. I go back.
Right.
I just want to see if that is Oxford.
Yes.
There could be an Oxford in the United States.
No, he moved to Oxford to assist Tolkien in the editing of the Silmarillion. So this guy has got... He knows his fantasy, obviously.
Yes, he does.
Anyway, so my point is that when he... like, there's this mystery set up, and it goes... and he's told by a priest... who this eyeless priest who can look into his past, he says, well, tell me something about me that, you know, that proves you've got these magical powers. And I say, the last person that you had sex with was your brother's wife 3 months ago, or whatever it was. And you're like, oh, that's interesting. You're like, wow, like, oh, what's this mystery? And then, two chapters later, but that's the point, is that never came up, but it's like straight away, you're like, oh, that's interesting. But he doesn't really go into it anymore.
No, not at all.
And then, like, two chapters later, it just goes, and there's a woman, and we meet this woman, and we see stuff from her point of view, and she's pregnant in this castle in the north. You know, and you're just like, oh, and it's like immediately she's pregnant, and she's a bit pregnant that she's noticeably pregnant, but not too far along. And immediately, I just things started clicking together in my head. It's like, oh, the last person he slept with was the brother's wife, and so it's like, oh, so he slept with his brother's wife, which means if this is the character, because she's the right amount pregnant, because it's that 3 months later, it means that he is the brother of her husband. And you wait for a few minutes, like you read like another two pages, and then you go, oh, her husband is the son of the count, and who used to be the king. And he's like, oh, so that means Blaise is the son of the high priest of the northern kingdom who used to be, you know, and you put it all together. And you're like, and just as I did that, turn the next page, and it's like, and he's like, yeah, Blaise is the cat. And then it's like, he puts in enough places to make us feel clever. Well, not to make us feel clever, but he gives us the clues to work it out. But then he doesn't think, oh, these people are so stupid that if I keep it a secret all the way through to the end of it, or for like another four chapters, they've already worked out, so I don't need to keep it secret for them. Now I can just move on with the plot. And he does this time and time again. He gets to the point where we can put together the pieces. Like, for example, it's like, and someone comes in and he pulled his hood back, and it was, and like, as the person's coming in, I was like, oh, I bet this is this guy. And he pulls his head back, and it is, you know.
Yeah.
And all the time, as these things are happening, as these twists are happening, he's a good enough writer that we work it out. Oh, I was working it out and feeling clever about it, always like a page before, like, and then I'd turn the page or flick on with the ebook. So then I'd flick
and
to the next page of the ebook.
Really clever.
And then he would confirm it, or I'd have it all worked out and I'd turn the page and he would go, no, it's not that, it's actually this. And I'd be like, oh, great.
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah.
It's this thing, this is why I don't like spoilers all this time, is just because I like that feeling
that
of being
surprise.
Clever.
Oh, yes.
And I like
and
the feeling of being made feeling stupid, which also happens a lot.
And in that book, This is, the whole book is about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which is, makes it so difficult to not spoil anything because you can't really even talk about...
Like, I couldn't spoil everything. If I was to give away all of the spoilers in this book, it would take as long to explain them all and to give it away as it would be to read it. So you might as well just read it.
Read the book, yeah.
Things that... Okay, let's move on. I'll do some of the more stuff that I like about it as I compare it one-to-one to Curse of Chaelin in a bit. So let's just say what you didn't like about the book.
Okay, what I didn't like. So there was this part which suddenly was narrated in the present tense.
Yes.
And I immediately saw that and I pointed out to you and said, well, why is that? And until the end, maybe I didn't read close enough or something, I did not figure out why that part in the Northern Castle was suddenly in present tense.
It was because it wasn't in Arbonne. It was the stuff that wasn't in Arbonne was told in present tense, and the stuff in Arbonne was told in present tense.
Yes, but that doesn't really...
It didn't do anything. It was purely a distraction. It was one of the main negative points for me as well, because every time I was reading it, I was just like, there is no need for this at all.
Yeah, exactly.
It felt like a writing exercise.
Yes.
It felt like the whole book had been written in one or the other.
Can I make it so I stay in the present tense without going back into past tense?
No, this chapter. Yeah.
I don't know. It was a bit distracting and it was weird, and I thought, well, is there something clever about it? Maybe I didn't miss it. Maybe there was a point when it all came together and then suddenly it like came together and all in one tense or something. I don't know. Anyway, that was one point I didn't really like. And also, sometimes the language is quite colorful and floral, or how you say that, but sometimes it was a bit over the top. I don't have an example. There was some
mellifluous, that was the word that you didn't know. The writing in the book is mellifluous, which is a good word, except I can't say it. And Juliana didn't know what it meant. And I was like, she was like, what's this word? I said, just look it up, press the thing. And she said, I'm not connected to the internet, so I don't know what I didn't have the dictionary connected.
So there was this one person here, and that person brought out Goodreads. Lisieux of
You've got to talk towards the microphone.
Yes, I do. But I can't look at my computer and do this.
Okay.
Lisieux du Vézé realized with a cold dawning of despair that her heart was gone from her. It had left without her knowing, like a bird in winter, flying north to a hopelessly wrong destination where no haven or warmth or welcome could ever be imagined.
The thing is, she...
I mean, it fits.
The thing is, she is a musician. This is the writing that I thought it was a bit overdone, but she is a musician. So when you're when the action is concentrating on a musician, it's more mellifluous.
Yeah.
I don't even
maybe.
Know.
Maybe.
But then when you're concentrating on the bad guys, it's like, oh, and now we'll go into present tense and
the bad guys are really bad and really straight and very... almost German-like
I wouldn't say the German-like.
No, but sometimes they were like really bad.
Yeah.
It was clear who was the bad guy.
Yes, this is another bad point, is that sometimes, again, I realise we've got all the way this fight. It's like, why are we reviewing this book? Is this a fantasy book? We haven't even mentioned magic once. You know, there is the magic in this book is so little.
There's
a few people have a few visions. It is real because, you know, the gods are real in a way, or there is some supernatural stuff going on.
But only some.
Only some, but it's like, yeah, some people have visions, this other person. It's more like mild supernaturalism than, you know, fantasy, which isn't a bad thing. But there's was it Gorhout? What's the name of the guy in the north?
Adamar.
Yeah, Coran. There's a king in the north. No, the god in the north is Coran.
Coranus.
Yeah, let me just bring it up here. Galbert, the high priest of Coran.
Yeah, and the god's called Coranus.
Oh, is it Coranus?
Yeah.
But he was a high priest. Now, we know that the priestesses of Rhian down in the south, they had these powers. And I was always wondering, what powers did he have? This is a question for you. What powers did he have in the north? Was he such a great political person because he could also see into the future a bit and he could also read people's minds or know stuff about them secretly?
Oh, this guy, Galbert.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
Why not?
I felt totally that he used the god as an excuse to go and just burn.
No, he was doing his god's work, like the priests
really?
Were, like the pope was doing in the Middle Ages. How they would actually say, look, this. It actually says here on Wikipedia, the Albigensian Crusade, which is a word I realize I've only ever read, and the Cathar Crusades, I know it was the Cathar Crusades, is when the Pope was like, oh, these Cathars in Provence, let's go and wipe those out. Yeah, and they said, anyone who volunteers coming in, they can get land there. And everyone's like, let's go. So this kind of stuff does happen, and it is political, but it is also religiously based. This is one of the things that I think is actually a flaw in the book, is that in the South, we know that Rian is a real god, or there is some kind of fantasy element down there. Actually, we see it.
Yeah.
But they say, oh, we also acknowledge Corin or worship Corin as well, but you are Corin monotheists, and we are down here dualists or some kind of...
Which is also what is the parallel to this crusade.
Yeah. Yeah. But my point is that, like, if the fantasy is true, how come he didn't have any powers? And if he did have powers, why weren't they mentioned? Or anyway, so it was. Sometimes I was thinking the fantasy in this book is so the fantasy touch is so light that it is almost just, it's like alternative history. It's almost like alternative history fantasy. But then there's some parallels which are a bit too close. Like some of the words, like there's even the Andorra. There's like the Count of Andorra turns up, but it isn't Andorra, it's Andoria. I was like, Andoria, that's a little bit too close. So sometimes I was like, make it more secondary world, make it more fantasy, make it less like this. But in other times I was like, well, it's too close sometimes.
Yeah. According to this, like, that fits very, very well into it. The end, like, I don't really want to spoil something, but this is about somebody saying about the behavior of the goddess of Rian, and she says the goddess will sometimes intercede for us, but she always wants to see that we have tried to aid ourselves.
Yeah,
and I really like that because it's a very practical point of view of a god.
Yeah,
which is like, oh, there will be some kind of support.
Yeah,
but you have to. God help. We have to see that you want to try it.
God like helps what Andy those Murray who
didn't do now.
Yeah, God helps. God helps them who help themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is their practical.
I can't believe you're making tennis references. Nobody cares. Nobody cares about the French Open.
Doesn't matter. So this is a really thing that I really like about these people in Arbonne. They are really practical thinking people all the way through.
Yeah. You think it's all the old wishy-washy, you know, stuff, but it's actually, nope, we are doing this stuff, we are going out of our way, we are doing this stuff, working towards it.
Yeah.
So, I don't think there's any other things that I want to talk about that I don't like about this. Overall, I think it's very well plotted, the pacing is good throughout. Like, when it first starts off, you have, like, the same opinion as Blaise going, oh, is it all just going to be about women and singing and stuff? And I'm like, no, holy fuck, they use music as an act of war. They are using their, you know, their songwriting as an act of propaganda and political maneuvering in war, and that's what I really liked.
Yes.
So let's skip on to this section, which I wanted to do. At the end of The Curse of Caelion, we were saying, well, why don't you just read this? You were like, this is alternative. This is not alternative Spain, this is alternative France. So I'm going to go through some points. And I must admit that we're coming down to the subjective judgment of, what are you doing? You're putting that music on again.
No, I thought just at the end we can just find out.
Yeah, let me do this first, and then we can put the music on to finish up. Maybe we'll get on one of your CDs and you can play some of your music maybe at the end. Put on some Dowland.
I find some Dowland.
Not yet, we'll do it at the end.
Talk your Caelion.
So what I want to say is that because I rate these books as purely, like, with my star ratings, it's purely subjective. I know for a fact that one of the reasons I liked this book so much was because it wasn't Curse of Caelion. And I have to say this, like, just to be honest, because if I started reading this book, I'd be like, well, it's okay, it's not for me. But it was like, it's like this came out in 92, you said?
Yes.
It's like, now looking back at it, I thought this was recent, this was a more recent book, but it isn't, it's older. And I realise now it's like, did she, what's her name? Luke McMaster-Bajold, did she just read this book and go, I will take all of those scenes and make them shit. I will take all of those ideas and make them... No, it really is like that. So, for example, okay, let's go through this. The very beginning of this book, what happens at the very beginning of this book?
You have this scene where they...
There's an ambush.
Yes.
Okay, that scene is in Curse of Caelion. They go out for a ride with the two women? Princesses. And they go out for a ride, and what happens? They are ambushed. And almost immediately in Curse of Chalion, it's like, and there's an ambush, and he gets out his sword and it's like, and he's like, oh, these are our friendly people. It's not a real ambush. Oh, ha, 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 like that. And then, like, another whole chapter goes past, and then after the ambush, they did this, and then they did this, and then they had these war games, and these other people came in, these people pretended to be pirates, and then they all got together, and they all went way, and then they had a drink, and then they got together for a picnic, and then this person sat next to this person leaned over this way, and they said that to this. And I'm just like, what the fuck am I reading this for? And here at the beginning, I was like, oh, this is exactly in the same as Curse of Chalion, except in this, the woman gets abducted, shoots a guy in the chest as part of the game. This guy's, they said, oh, I told you to put on your, yeah, I'm giving away, this is the prologue, we're not giving so much away, yeah. But it's one of those things, it's just like, oh, she really played along, and the woman wasn't just someone who had to be, she had a bow and arrow with her. She was fighting stuff. And she knew it was a game. She knew it was a game. It was all this political play and this romance stuff.
Yeah.
Then they go in this thing. And instead of this, like, in Curse of Chalion, this whole ambush leads to a picnic where two people have a conversation. In this, it leads to this forbidden tryst between a troubadour and another countess's wife. And it leads to the woman taking her clothes off and saying, you want to have sex with me? Okay, let's have sex. But it's that my time of the month, and we are going to conceive. Not my time of the month, but you're like, I am going to have sex with you now. And
we make a baby.
We're going to make a baby now. And he's like, what? No, shit. I thought this was just meant to be a love thing. And like, right at the very beginning, it's like the women have the power. The women, even though they, even in this book, they complain, oh, we're just political pawns. We get married off here and there. It's like, we don't want that. And everyone's like, oh, we don't want that. But they take it, and right away I was just like, this is the opposite scene, even though the same thing happens with the, like, this fake thing. Okay, next point. Marriage for politics. Then, like, two chapters in, they're like, the guy goes, oh, well, what you should do, the brother, or whatever he is, he just goes, oh, he's the old champion of the king, and he says to the champion of the king, oh, what you should do is just marry the bitch. He's like, what? Marry, like, what you should do for political reasons is you should get married to someone from the kingdom next door. And they pretty much just go, don't be fucking stupid, that's not going to happen, that's just, don't, what are you even talking about, like that. And that seems to be, like, the characters in this book are telling Lewis McMaster Bujold, saying, what the fuck? The resolution of your story is like a politically convenient marriage between two people who very conveniently happen to be exactly the same age or in the same stage of life, who very conveniently both happen to be the last in their line, who very conveniently both are young and beautiful and don't like war, who just very, it's just like everything is convenience, and the way out of it is a political marriage. Whereas in this, it's just like, don't be fucking stupid. That's the stupidest idea ever. What are you even talking about? What is this? Don't treat the reader as stupid. Oh, yeah. I mentioned that before about how, like I say, it's not like, oh, and then this happens, and then this happens. It's like, oh, I wonder, you know, in The Curse of Chalion, it's just like, and now there's mystery, and then someone comes in and says, ah, oh, and this happened, that happened, that happened, that happened, that happened. And you're like, so what, our main character didn't have to find anything out? He just, yeah. he didn't even ask us.
And the reader itself.
Yeah, and the reader, we didn't ever get a chance to wonder or pick up any clues about who the guy who did the death magic at the start of Curse of Chalion was. Before we even could give any clues, someone just comes in and says, oh, it was this guy over this here. And, like that.
And the whole, like, the whole mystery where you thought, oh, this is great, there will be something be developed out of that,
yeah,
is immediately turned down and is boring.
Yeah, it's immediately boring. Okay, another thing. Something to fight against. Religious crusades is actually a real thing which would devastate countries. Like, people would come in.
It was.
And they would just come in and just...
Oh, it,
like,
still is.
Yeah, it still is, I guess. But it was one of those things that when they go, oh, we're going down to... like, all the knights going down through Europe. And they're like, oh, we're going down to Jerusalem to on a crusade. And it's like, but we need supplies. Well, let's just sack this city. And that one there is like...
Yeah.
And one of the main things that... I mean, there's been other fantasy books that talked about this as well. When the crusading armies got to Constantinople, they were just like, fuck, don't let them in. They'll just sack the place. And, like, loads of political maneuvering in the crusades was just, like, as the crusading armies were passing through... Not even the crusade that they were going to... The country that the crusade was going to, but just where they would pass along the way, it's just like, fuck, we got to get these guys out of here. This is a really dangerous situation.
Yes.
And so the danger here is actually real to the people. Like, the people, the leaders of our bond do not want, it's not just like, oh, if the bad guys come in, we will be replaced and there will be no difference at all for the people who we rule. Like, it's like they actually care about the people who rule. There's culture, there's
also
stuff.
What is part of this is that it's not only the people in Arbonne, this is also how they get their allies, because they say, hey, look, these people from Go'o, they're not going to stop here.
Yeah.
Once they have the stealth here, yeah, they will just go to the other places.
Yeah.
And then the other place saying, ah.
Yeah, Andoria is not going to be there, and Portese, well, Italy,
you,
yeah.
Ah, you might be right. Oh, shit. So yeah, maybe.
It, like I say, it feels real. And also, the bad guy, it is a bit of a cartoon villain. Like, we meet him, and it's like, well, how do we meet one of the main bad guys? Well, we meet him.
He does lots of bad stuff.
Well, it's not that. We meet him, and he's sitting on his throne, getting a blowjob in front of all the people.
Don't say that.
But what he does, like, that whole scene, it's like, oh, he's the bad guy. And then someone worse comes in, and you're like, oh, no, that's the bad guy. You know, you actually know the bad guy. Whereas in The Curse of Chalion, who was the bad guy? He was a guy who was, you know, he was bad because he wanted power from the people who should have had power. Like, he was going to take over and run the country instead of the royal family, which wasn't all that bad, you know? I mean, I know it's weird to say this, but, like, if in the book, I don't really... It's not that I want to hate the bad guy, but I want to, like...
Want to have bad feelings about
it. Yes, it's like you want to...
And in that book, really, like, there was some chapter...
In which book? Song for Abon.
Yeah. Where I really, like, I felt disgusted about the bad guy.
Yeah.
Just about
but
like,
also
how
there
he
was
behaved.
There was also a character arc for some of the other people who you think were bad guys. Yeah. That you start off and they're like, oh, I understand that guy actually might not be that bad, but he's been manipulated. Oh, this guy, that guy over there was really bad, but there was a little bit more complexity to it.
The levels of complexity about people's personalities is actually really big. Like, in normal life, you can't just have a really bad guy, and he's bad all the way through, and a good guy who's always good.
In this one,
you have people who are good, but sometimes do bad things. And you have bad people.
There is one character. Yeah, that's. Let me put it this way: the counts who are like the main one of the main guys, Bertrand, who is this count who lives in the castle and who had the affair at the beginning. It's like, man, you had this affair with this other countess's wife. You fucked up your country for 22 years, and you're still fucking up. The country could fall because you had this affair, and you won't just kiss and make up. It's like, even though he's not the main, he is obviously like, I'm the count and everyone loves me.
Yeah, yeah.
But of people are just going, stop being a fucking idiot.
Yes. So it's all the way through, you really like this count because he's really fun.
Yeah.
But then he has this part and this is really good. Because
but what about
this
Blaze? Is there a few times where Blaze is a bit...
Yeah, he is a northerner. He has this big beard and he has all these issues and stuff. But also, at some point, he's really like... When he gives a smile, you really feel,
he's
not that bad.
I mean, at least he had to work for stuff, unlike the main guy. Yeah, I can't even remember the main guy's name in Curse of Chalion. Casserole. Yeah. So Casserole. But like, Casserole just didn't do anything. Anyway, I don't want to go into that, but that's just bad writing and bad character work. In this one, I do think it was a bit weird that Blaze was like really... really good. And at the end, this is another thing as well, another point, like at the end of Curse of Chalion, it's like, and now you have won a girl and you have won a title and stuff like that. You know, he was just involved in the saving the royal family, and you get the girl and you get this and you get married, yeah, like this. And here at the end of this, what I do like is that even though it's a bit weird how all the women are attracted to him, Blaze, this is, and it's like, oh, who's he gonna pick? Who's he going to pick to get married at the end? Because, you know, he gets the thing and it's like, who's he going to be? And you realise, oh, fuck, he doesn't actually... The woman he loves isn't really available and she fucked him over and she's a bad person anyway. And then there's other person he really likes, but she's not highborn enough and he can't get together with her. And there's this other person over here which be the convenient person to get married political, but there's a one over here. And it's like, and it's not like, and you have won the girl that you liked all the way through, who was the only available female, and now you have won her. Like, at the end, it's like, oh, shit, he's still got to make... bad political decisions or good political decisions about who he's going to marry for convenience and not out of love. He leaves behind the women he's actually attracted to, and it's like, well, I guess I've got to get together for political reasons with this one over here. You know, it feels a bit more grown up.
Yeah. And there's one thing I want to mention. I don't know if it's a spoiler, but there's this game where he does something and he wins 3 roses.
Oh yes, that's quite
good. And then he's giving away the roses to the women. And
yeah,
it's like,
one's a red rose, a white rose, and a yellow rose.
Yeah, whatever. And it's like this really big symbolism, and it's this really big thing in front of every people.
Yeah.
And I really like how this is played out and how this is like all like.
But it shows that the relationships are grown-up relationships. Yeah. It's not like, oh,
I'll have to do it in
secret. You have a rose to give to someone. Who are you going to give the rose to? you. And it's like, oh, great. But it's like, you've got three roses. Who are you going to give it to? It's like, okay, well, I need to give one to... This woman is important for my past. This woman is important for my future. This one is important politically. And this one is... Yeah. She wants me, but whatever, you know, that kind of thing.
It's really great.
Another thing that I really like about the adult relationships in Curse of Caelian, it's like, oh, and they're the girls are virgins, and he wasn't a virgin, but he lost his virginity really late, you know, and this over here, and it's all like, oh, and they get married, and they maybe kiss. Oh, are they going to kiss? Oh, they held hands. Oh, they held hands. It's like, is this for 12-year-olds? Like, you know, as I was reading it, and in this, it's like, oh, there's this tradition on Midsummer's Night, nobody goes to bed alone. Who are we going to fuck tonight? And it's just like, this fucking doesn't mean anything because it's Midsummer's Night, but you got to fuck someone. Oh, I'm going to fuck. Oh, I've ended up in the same bed as someone I fucked for the last 3 years. It's like, maybe there's something.
The thing is, it's not like, oh, the men go around and say, ah, I want you.
It's not like,
a balanced thing.
But it's like, the whole point in this Curse of Caelian is just like, just if you're going to have sex, if you're 37 and you're going to have sex with a 19-year-old, just do it. Like, if you think you're grooming her to, you know, in this weird relationship, why do we have to wait until the end? Why do it have to be this big flowery wedding? Like, why do we have to go through all of that? Just fuck her. Like, she wants it. Like, even though it's, like, really weird that you're, like, almost twice her age, if you're gonna do it, just go for it. Just fucking just get on with it. Like, you're adults. She's not an adult, but if you think she's an adult, and there's that weird thing, it's like, why is this whole pure white wedding thing going on at the end when it's like this really creepy relationship? Anyway,
and also I think this is also a point where what Luke tries to say here is that if you make a thing out of sex, it feels weird. But if you just treat it as something that is done...
Everybody's doing this. We mentioned this right at the very beginning.
You feel really like, oh yeah, okay, well, they enjoy each other, and they have fun here.
In this book, there are men set to guard the women, and the women who they are guarding go out and fight the men who are meant to be guarding them so their illicit lovers can come in and get them. It's like the polar opposite of Curse of Caelian. It's like, oh, young and fresh and virginal, I have to protect her for me later, but I have to protect her, you know. It's a really weird thing. Okay, so adult, not so much adult relationships, but just an adult treatment of sex. Like, we're all consenting adults here, yeah? Okay, well, let's just all have sex with who we want to on one night. Of course, it is a bit like, you know, it's not real like that, but like, why? Just because it's medieval fantasy, why don't nightclubs exist where people go out to have sex with each other? You know, that's why, like, why when you go to university, like, everyone's there, everyone's trying to fuck all the time. Like, why isn't that ever here as well?
Really, that's not how in Germany university works.
Yeah, well,
experienced.
Yeah, well, it can happen. So,
you really want to go through all
No, there's a, because I've done this one. No, everyone affects the plot. No one talked about this one. You have won a girl. Oh, yeah. So we mentioned before about the scouring of the Shire. Why did we bring this up? But you were talking about, like, what happens at the end. Like, at the end of Curse of Caelian, we got the whole section, which is just like, and now the whole plot is resolved. And now let's have an hour where they go home and he has a recovery and then they get married and he gets this. You know, it's like this, like, hour and a half of audiobook after the plot is finished.
happy end.
And then it's just like, and now wrap it up. And in this book, it's just like, we get to the end.
And it's like, and then that.
There's a little bit of a prologue where they just go, oh, this one mystery here, that's how it wrapped up. And you're like, oh, that's nice to discover that. And then it ends and then you finish. So that was it.
But until the very end, it is really like, the pace is very light. You look in one direction and then you think, maybe I should that.
Yeah.
Who's doing what? Oh,
yeah, yeah. All the way through to the end, the plot is driven through to the end. And we talked about the scouring of the Shire. Like, at the end of the... One thing that they've messed up with the Lord of the Rings movies is that the big battle ended and then they have another three endings where it's like, and now they get off the mountain and now this person gets married. Oh, and now this person wakes up in bed and then they're back in the Shire and then something else happens in the Shire and then later on they go out to sea and then even later on he writes up, you know, it keeps going and there isn't that scouring of the Shire moment which is just punched up, you know, just to punch up the end that all through the story the hobbits have learned this lesson and then they get back to the Shire and then they have to put in place the lessons that they've learned about fighting for them.
And now this really great quote, which I found on the Wikipedia page of
Guy Gabriel K. Yeah,
fits really well because he worked with the son of Tolkien.
Yeah,
the son. He said, to be successful in fantasy, you have to take the measure of Tolkien, work with his strengths and away from his weaknesses.
Yeah, this is also like an anti Lord of the Rings in just how fast paced it is. Like, you know, and they travel from here to there, but we're not going to spend any time on them traveling from there to there. We're going to skip over it and get to what happens when they got there.
And this feels very much like that.
Yeah.
This feels very much, oh, what is good about it and what is bad about it? We should avoid the bad.
Yeah.
We should go only for the good.
Another scene which comes straight out of this book is, there's this scene, I don't want to, actually, it doesn't matter. Let's just explain it. In The Curse of Chalion, there's a scene where they go, and then there was this mystical bird, and you're like, okay, mystical bird. What was the mystical bird in this, in Song for Abon?
Owls,
yeah. In the Curse of Chalion, it's the ravens around the castle. It's ravens. Okay, there's a raven. He's a raven. He treats the raven nicely. Raven, like, raven. And now it's like, okay, is this person real or not real? Let's ask the gods. How are we going to ask the gods? Well, we're going to set the one person on one side and set the other person on the other side, and we'll have the raven in the middle, and then we'll let go of the raven, and whoever it flies to, that's the person who has the gods and stuff like that. And he just spent like an hour.
That person hit some dead mice behind his back? Or
no, he's been feeding the raven all along.
It is kind of like that.
Yeah. He's just been feeding the raven. The raven is his best friend. It's like, oh, because that raven came down for the testing, they caught that. They had to catch a raven to bring it into test it. It's like, well, of course he's going to get it. And it's just this really long, boring, tedious, obvious ending to it. And in this book, what happens? At one point, I'm not going to give it away, but at one point he says, well, what do you think I should do? Do you think I should just do this? And he says it as a joke. But the owl comes and lands on his shoulder. And they're like, holy shit, was that a sign from the god? But it was one sentence. The owl immediately flew over and landed on his shoulder. Why can't we have that? Why do we have to have like this hour of audiobook talking about this trial that's set up? And he's go over here and do, oh, is he going to call the bird's name? Is he going to call his name because he's been trying to teach that baby to whatever? Just get on with it. You can do the same. You can have the same message of being touched by the gods or being commanded by the gods or being approved by the gods in a sentence. The fucking owl flew over, landed on his shoulder. That's all we need.
Hey. You what? Already had a big rant about the Curse of Chalion.
But anyway, that's all to bring up. Let's stop talking about that. But what it comes down to is I really enjoyed this book. And like I say, if I had just read this book as it is, like without reading Curse of Chalion beforehand, I reckon
you still would have enjoyed it.
I would have enjoyed it, but it would have been like a 3.5 star because it's not all it. But because of this, I'm going to bump it up to 4 star book I have to explain that. So maybe this isn't for everyone, but it was certainly a book for me because it was, like I say, it was the anti-Curse of Chalion.
Yeah.
It's even got a similar name. Song for Abon, Curse of Chalion, you know.
It has the same rhythm. Yeah, I also give it 4 stars, I think.
Why not 5 stars if you enjoyed it so much?
Yeah, there were some paragraphs in it where you have a lot of thinking about the things that goes on, the politics that takes place in the people's heads and stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not so much of a fan of this kind of...
Well, like exposition-y, internal
and
monologues.
As I said, some of the things I had some issues with. But overall, I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah, I had issues as well. Like, what's going to happen? One thing I did like about Curse of Chalion that it didn't finish in a big battle. And this one, it's like, of course, that's what it's set up at the beginning. It's like, it's going to be... But it would have been nice if the resolution hadn't have been... And now,
I mean, it goes down
fight.
A bit.
Yeah,
it goes down a
in,
bit.
In the winter section, I think the strongest parts is the spring, summer, and autumn. And then when it actually gets to the big Dunamore and the battle between the two people, it even though it's interesting, there's still twists and things.
There's still a twist, but it's quite a real big revelation of everything.
Yeah, it's just like, and now let's go through, oh, we need a big battle. Shit, big battle. Let's do the big fantasy battle, medieval fantasy battle. Yeah. Let's go. And I would have liked it if it could have been a little bit cleverer than that at the end. And yes.
So this is why I give it 4 stars. It has some things, but I really, really had a lot of fun with it.
Okay, me too. 4 stars. Yeah. Let's talk about the next book that we're going to do Ringworld.
Ringworld.
Yeah, and then we're going to get on and do the last few books. We've got 3 more books in the Ian M. Banks culture read through, but we're going to do Ringworld first. What else should we say? Yeah, you can become my friends on goodreads.com. Also become Juliana's friend on goodreads.com and recommend books to her and me.
I do read the recommendations, as
yeah,
you can
of
see.
Course. And we got to it this time. You'd already downloaded this ebook, hadn't you? So you stuck it across onto onto my iPad. So we both did this one. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. I read every email and respond to every email, especially if you ask me a question. I do answer every thing. If you have a book that you're selling or promoting in some way, don't email me. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge on Twitter. You can also join in with the Goodreads.com SFBRP listener group, and the new thread that's turned up has been about me talking about American Gods by Neil Gaiman, which got quite a few people reacted to that and said, yeah, I also am totally bored by that book. So I want you, if you read Neil Gaiman's American Gods and you think it's amazing, just... I don't mind about spoilers, just explain to me in two paragraphs or one paragraph what it is about that book that you think is so great that you have to give it 5 stars. Because most people say, oh, it's a great book, it's this and this, but nobody's really specific. It's like, this is a better book than it could have been because of this. You know, it's like, oh, I like Neil Gaiman, so I like this book. Anyway, so email me if you can, or join in with the SFBRP listener group discussion, because it's only everyone who I've encountered on Goodreads so far who's replied to the review and talked in this thread has said, oh yeah, I thought it was boring too. I didn't get to the end. Didn't even get halfway through.
Aww.
Like you with Curse of Chaelion. Right then, that's it from me. Say goodbye, Juliana.
Goodbye.
Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Can she excuse
this is you.
It's
me, yeah.
Shall I call her good?
Is that a lute or a guitar?
It's a guitar, but it's lute music.
Lute music.
Yeah, played on a guitar.
Sting did his version with a lute.
I don't want you to compare me with Sting.
What? No. He did Jump Down Rondell. You've got a very medieval voice.
Oh, thank you. I live in present times.
Cold love is like two words written on sand.
Ben is very good at guitar though, isn't he?
This is. Yeah. Why I'm playing music with him.
He's super good looking too. So where can people find this music? They can't really, can they? I mean, they have to order a CD.
They have to order a CD. Or they go on the website.
Dewey Music Sheet.
DUEMUSICI.DE.
Due Musici.
Yeah, it's Italian. Due Musici.
Yeah. Or search for Juliana Kunzendorf and yeah, you'll find.
You can find me. Okay. So that's the second word. Do you want to play it a bit more?
Yeah, let's go to the end. We've only got a minute left. So this was written about Queen Elizabeth then?
Yes, totally. Completely.
Can she excuse my wrong?
What can granted be if she will yield to that which reason is? It is reason's will that love should be just. Make me happy still by granting this. Oh, cut off delays if that die I must.
It's very sad.
Better 1,000 times to die than...
It's not as sad as some of the other ones.
Ah, the sadder ones, yeah.
Flow my tears. It's almost like I guess it's almost a cliche kind of thing, but this kind of started the cliche, like this super romantic, like, oh, I hope she loves me. Can she excuse my wrongs?